Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Topeka Shiner, the rusty-patched bumblebee, the Powashik skipper butterfly, the wood turtle. This hour, we are going to take some time to talk about some of the small creatures that live in Iowa, creatures that are endangered, threatened, or of special concern. We'll also talk about some of our endangered plant species and discuss why we should know and care about these species. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions, your observations, your species of special concern. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And my first guest today is Craig McPeak. He is supervisor for the Illinois and Iowa Ecological Services Field Office at the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. Hello, Craig.
Hello, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Absolutely.
And I want to start with these tiny species that most of us will never see, have never seen. Why do you think this is a conversation we should be having? Why do we need to know about these little species?
That's a great question, Charity. And I think you can look at some of these species and just with a little bit of research uncover an adventurous world out there of, like you mentioned, the Iowa Pleistocene snail and northeast Iowa and algific talus slopes, and opens your minds up to some of the landscapes in Iowa that still harbor, you know, habitat for these unique species, and draws us out into nature and gives us additional reasons to protect some of the really unique spots of Iowa.
These small species that we don't necessarily see, how do we keep track of them? How do we even know if they're threatened or endangered?
Sure. You know, one of the greatest things about Iowa is the conservation community is very strong with our local conservation districts, the Iowa DNR and their wildlife biologists, state or their private lands biologists, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service folks that sort of partner together to go out and do the surveys and status checks on some of these species. And through that, as well as some of the community and citizen science stuff that's going on, you know, we recognize areas that maybe we don't know as much as we'd like to know about a particular moth or a butterfly or a snail or a snake. And so collectively, I think the conservation community goes out and tries to get that information to inform what is that status and should we be concerned, and if so, how concerned.
Well, let's talk about the Topeka Shiner, which I know is a species of particular interest to you. Tell me about this little minnow.
Sure. You know, it's a neat little fish in north central Iowa, and as well as a population up in the northwest corner. But the most of the population exists in the North Raccoon River watershed and the Boone River watershed. And, you know, it's in these small upland streams, prairie streams that still exist and still have a lot of their natural characteristics left. But the unique thing about the Topeka Shiner, Charity, is it actually thrives in the wetland oxbow habitats that are adjacent to these streams. And, you know, the story could sort of end there, that we went out, as I mentioned, and analyzed the population and found that maybe there wasn't as many as there ought to be. But what the story really is how the local landowners, the farmers in that part of Iowa, really embraced those oxbow habitats. They embraced them from restoration, and they went out and spent some of their own money, as well as some funds from the Fish and Wildlife and the Iowa DNR to begin to restore those habitats, which really set off a population increase in some of these areas for that fish. And then we've since learned that these oxbows actually can help with water quality. They help to retain and consume nitrates that are in some of our streams. And so it's really been a fascinating story of acceptance from these landowners. And, we've learned a lot. And I just think it's one of the greatest conservation stories in Iowa.
Well, and let's talk about the history a little bit. When did we first identify this as a species that was at risk?
Yeah, back in the late 90s, a professor, Dr. Menzel out of Iowa State, had been doing some research and documented a pretty significant decline in the Topeka Shiner population and in 1997, 98 time frame, did a lot of that work. And then in 2000, the Fish and Wildlife Service did list it as a federally endangered minnow, which, you know, that always kind of opens up the checkbook, if you were. Some funds become available, and additional research through Iowa DNR and Iowa State University began to do follow-up surveys, which found some streams they'd almost been completely extirpated from, and other streams they were still holding on. So in the early 2000s, it really took off.
And as landowners embraced the idea of these wetlands, what kind of incentives were there for landowners to take an interest and to help save this little species that, again, they probably didn't have a lot of emotional attachment to?
You're absolutely right. And I would say to you, the one emotional attachment that they did have was fear, just because the Endangered Species Act, and that's something we struggle with all the time, Charity, is just the fear that a species is going to become listed and somehow stop individuals or project proponents from doing what they're trying to accomplish. And I think once we were able to, you know, meet with landowners and drink coffee together and talk about, you know, there's really nothing to be scared of here. The fish exists in some places, and if we embrace as a community restoration techniques, then ultimately perhaps we could recover it. And once they, you know, sort of got over that initial fear, I think that somehow they wouldn't be able to graze cattle in their pastures or in these streams, and we recognized that, no, that's all still going to be part of how we manage our landscapes. That was, I think, the biggest thing, Charity, was just that, you know, to get folks to not be scared of the Endangered Species Act or scared of having the Topeka Shiner in a stream that runs through their land.
And how is the Topeka Shiner doing today?
It's doing really well. There's been over 60 restoration projects in the North Raccoon River watershed, specifically for the Topeka Shiner. There's been 5 or 10 in the Boone River watershed, supported by the Iowa Soybean Association and the Iowa DNR. And so those restoration activities have really, we've now seen a spike in some of the numbers of fishes that are collected when we go out and do our surveys. Minnesota and South Dakota have similar increases in stable populations in some of those streams. Where the fish exists in Nebraska, Kansas, and Missouri, it's not doing very well. But those populations are a very different landscape and additional threats to deal with in those states. But here in Iowa, the fish is doing quite well at this point.
Let's talk a little bit about the endangered species list, because we have this federal endangered species list, but we also have an endangered species list for Iowa. What's the difference?
Yeah, that's a great question, and another place where, you know, the lack of information can be confusing to people. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, we look at the status of the species in its entire range. So like I just mentioned there, the Topeka Shiner exists in Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, Minnesota, and Iowa. And so that's the scale and scope at which we analyze the population and how it's doing and ultimately make a decision on whether it should or shouldn't be threatened or endangered. Whereas the state, you know, they would look at it much more closely to how is it doing in their state within the borders of the state of Iowa, for example. And you could have, for example, a species that's doing very well at the full range, but not doing very well at all in a state, and it may end up being listed in the state list as a species of concern or a threatened species. However, at its full range, at a 6 or 7 state scale, maybe it's doing quite well, and so it wouldn't be federally protected.
When we hear about a species like the Topeka Shiner, this is a really small species. It lives in our water. We know that water quality in Iowa and in the Midwest is something of great concern. When a species like this becomes endangered, what does that tell us?
Well, I think, you know, it tells us maybe we ought to think about how things are connected and should we be concerned about, you know, like you said, water quality, our own health. Many times these species that catch our attention as species of concern, you know, ecology tells us they're connected to so many other things, and it may be one of those other things that maybe needs our attention, soil health or vegetation or water quality or air quality. And so, you know, not to abuse the canary in the coal mine, but really, and that's really playing out with as we look into the monarch butterfly and thinking about some of these insects and this pollinator group with our native pollinators. And so the monarch butterfly and the concern about its population has really led us to, should we be concerned about pollinators in general, and is there ample and sufficient habitat for pollinators? And Iowa has been just wonderful in organizing through the DNR and Iowa State University, thinking about pollinator habitat and delivering that and protecting that in Iowa. So when a species, you know, catches our attention as a species of concern or becomes threatened or endangered, one, it should alarm us about, is there something else? And we should look into what are all these things that are connected to it. But two, I think it should tell us that maybe we ought to go back and look at some of our surveys and why didn't we catch this before it became threatened? Maybe we missed something earlier.
Well, and it also raises a lot of questions about how many species may have disappeared before we even knew they existed.
Absolutely, especially with the insects and to your segment today with the tiny species. You know, there are so many out there that haven't even been identified yet. And so are they already gone before we've had the chance?
So let's say I'm not somebody with an oxbow on my land. I can't specifically influence the habitat for, say, the Topeka shiner. But how should an individual change their behavior if they care about these little endangered species?
I think just setting out a goal, right? And so, and you could set a goal if you just own a backyard, for example. Well, what's your goal for your backyard? Is it just to sit and have maybe a campfire and enjoy the stars, or do you want to have a little area in the corner that would be available for some of these pollinators? Urban, rural alike, we can deliver habitat for pollinators, and you can use native plants, and you can use native plants in your landscaping to attract pollinators, increase habitat for pollinators, but increase just the aesthetics of your property. And you can scale that up from your backyard. The city of Cedar Rapids is doing wonderful things right now, thinking about pollinator habitat on some of their city parks and golf courses and roadways, all the way up to counties and the state of Iowa's plan for monarch butterfly habitat. And so everyone can do something, particularly for some of these pollinators and smaller species that, you know, a lot of times they just need a little bit.
Craig McPeak, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Craig McPeak is supervisor for the Illinois and Iowa Ecological Services Field Office at the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. This hour, we are spending time talking about some of the little creatures, the species that are at risk in the state of Iowa. We will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about some of the littlest creatures that live in Iowa. We're talking about small species that are endangered, threatened, or of special concern. And you are welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call with questions or your observations. We can also get your email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And my next guest is Stephanie Shepherd, wildlife biologist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Hello, Stephanie.
Good morning.
Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Let's talk about pollinators. Craig was just bringing them up a little bit ago, and I know that's something that they are of special interest to you.
Yeah.
We've referred to the rusty-patched bumblebee a couple of times, and it's a really unique little species. Tell me about it.
Sure. The rusty-patched bumblebee is somewhat sadly notable because it's the first bumblebee to be listed in the Federal Endangered Species Act. It is a somewhat typical bumblebee as far as, being pretty large and having a really long flight period. So bumblebees, rusty-patched bumblebees, become active in April. The queens hatch from hibernating underground and start looking for nectar. And you can imagine, if you think about Iowa in April, there's not a lot of flowers blooming. So they're kind of looking, they're probably using open woodlands at that point to just get some nectar to use, and then they fly and have workers and males that the queens produce and don't go dormant again until September or October of the year. So they have a very long flight period and are looking for flowers the whole time. And so, like, that's kind of one of the biggest challenges with that species is making sure they have plenty of food.
So what are their habitat needs? What is putting them at risk?
Well, so there's probably a lot of things. You know, they definitely need open grassland or open areas with lots of floral resources, nectar, places they can get nectar. And then they're also probably impacted by climate change. You know, if climate change shifts kind of how the seasons, how long the blooming season is for certain, for certain flowers, how does that, is the bumblebee able to adjust to that? You know, that can be throw a wrench into things for the rusty patch. There's also issues with disease. And then, of course, because it is an insect, it can be sensitive to pesticides and pesticide drift into areas where it might be looking for flowers. So it's got a lot of challenges that it's facing.
So, you know, I encounter bumblebees not infrequently. How would I know if I saw a rusty patched bumblebee?
That's a really good question. And so interestingly, the queens, which are the really big guys. So if you've ever been out in the prairie and, you know, seen this gigantic bumblebee, that is probably a queen. And they can actually be pretty difficult to tell apart from one species to the other. But once you get the workers flying, which is happening right about now, you start to get worker bumblebees out there. And they're still pretty big. But the rusty patch is notable because it has a red patch on its abdomen, kind of right underneath the thorax, kind of on its back. And you can kind of, it's kind of the only species here in Iowa that really has that. There's some other species that can be kind of similar, but that's a really key characteristic with that is that rusty patch. So in this way, its name gives us an idea how to identify it.
Well, and a lot of people have been really concerned about honeybees in really the last decade or maybe even longer by this point with colony collapse disorder and really fears about losing the incredible benefits of this species. Honeybees are not a native species. Do you feel like they've really overshadowed some of these native pollinators?
I think it's definitely fine to be concerned about honeybees. That's a big, you know, economic issue with the colony collapse and the issues with that, cultivated species. But yes, I think it has, overshadowed a little bit our native species because in addition to bumblebees, you know, Iowa has probably 300 to 400 species of native bees that are out there doing a lot of the pollination, like they're making our ecosystems run basically with the services they're providing, going from flower to flower. And those species are really key to keeping our natural systems running. And, you know, I think they have a lot of interesting life histories and hopefully I think the, you know, attention is starting to shift to those native species.
Well, speaking of native species of pollinators, let's talk about the Powashik skipperling butterfly. And this is a butterfly that is extremely rare. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so the Powashik skipperling is the skipper butterflies, if you're not familiar with them, are kind of the sparrows of the butterfly world. They're kind of little, they're tiny, and they're sort of nondescript in their appearance.
So maybe not as gorgeous as the monarch.
Exactly. So they definitely are not as flashy as the monarch butterfly. They're very little, and they're kind of brown and orange, and so they're very easy to miss. First of all, if you're out running around. But they are a part of a group of skippers, butterflies, that are called prairie skippers or grass skippers that are really tightly tied to our remnant prairies, so prairies that have never been plowed.
Which they have very, very small acreage of. There just aren't a lot of those out there.
Right. We have very few of them, and the ones we do have are small and very fragmented, you know, very far away from each other. So because these critters are so tiny, you know, they can't move from spot to spot very easily. And a lot of these species in this group are really declining, and particularly Palaszczuk, which was listed as federally endangered a few years ago, and unfortunately has not been found in the wild, definitely in Iowa since the mid-2000s, and then, you know, elsewhere in its range. It's kind of an upper Midwest species. It's also becoming increasingly difficult to find even one individual. So unfortunately, that's a species that we might be losing. And, you know, there's a lot of other species in that group that are also becoming very, very rare. And this has kind of happened rapidly in the last 15 years. Like, they were definitely decreasing, you know, as we lost prairie habitat, but the significant declines have happened in the last 10 to 15 years.
So they may have already disappeared from the state of Iowa, but it's extremely difficult to know that, isn't it?
Right. It's really hard to prove that something isn't there, especially with a species that's little and kind of nondescript. You can do pretty intensive surveys and still miss it. So we don't necessarily have a lot of the resources to do those you know, really extensive, intensive surveys. But even if you do, it's just very easy to miss it, and it's very hard to say for sure that, you know, the species is gone or that we've lost it.
It's fascinating to think that this is a species that feeds on prairie grasses as a caterpillar, and that doesn't seem like a hard thing to offer the species. It doesn't seem, you know, when we think about planting milkweed for monarchs, prairie grasses, more people are planting them. They are more plentiful. But the fact that we were only finding them on unplowed remnants of prairie, what do you think that tells us?
Yeah, and I mean, I think this is partially what's at the root of the challenges with conserving these species, is that we're not entirely sure what has caused the rapid decline in years, because as you say, they eat some pretty common prairie grasses as a caterpillar, which they could find in any, you know, planted prairie, CRP field. But for some reason, they don't colonize those areas. They stick in the remnant prairie. So is that because the soil in the remnant prairie has some kind of, you know, mycorrhizae or soil bacteria that, you know, lives on the roots of those grasses and makes them special and more palatable for the skippers? Caterpillars, we don't entirely understand that dynamic, and so it makes it hard to figure out how to save them.
Let's talk about some of the other species on this list today. For example, the Henslow sparrow. I know you're not a bird expert, but here is another prairie grassland species.
Yeah, and the Henslow sparrow is kind of, so we just were talking about, you know, the sparrow of the butterfly kingdom, so it makes sense to move to an actual sparrow. They're, again, they're pretty secretive, and they're pretty good at hiding in prairie grasses, and they're not terribly flashy, though if you get a good look at one of them, they do have some nice dark striping and can, they have their own kind of beauty. And they have a very also nondescript call, so that can be easily missed if you're wandering around the prairie, you know, the being deafened by dixisles or other louder species. But the Henslow sparrow is it's not federally listed. It's threatened at the state level, and it's definitely threatened because of loss of habitat. And one thing that's interesting about it is that it has benefited greatly by CRP coming along, the Conservation Reserve Program, and private landowners, you know, putting their land into Conservation Reserve Program, because the Henslow sparrow really likes thick, grassy vegetation that hasn't been disturbed or burned in a long time. So, you know, lots of leaf litter, standing dead vegetation, and dense tall grass is kind of where its little niche in the grassland. And so CRP is kind of perfect for it.
And what do you think the outlook is for Henslow sparrows?
I think it's pretty good. Iowa's a pretty key spot for it. You know, there are still some concerns, but if we can continue to keep some grass on the landscape, I think they will hopefully persist and continue to take advantage of that. One area in Iowa recently in the last 6 months was actually recognized as a globally important bird area because of the number of breeding Henslow sparrows pairs, and that's the Callerton Wildlife Area down in South Central Iowa. So we've got some spots in Iowa that are really doing a good job of producing Henslow sparrow.
And of course, the Callerton area is best known for prairie chickens, which are a little bit bigger, maybe a little bit more charismatic than the little Henslow sparrows.
Exactly.
And so we're going to bring in another guest in just a moment. But before we do that, and we're going to talk about wood turtles with both of you, I want to talk about the green snake, the smooth green snake, which is a species of special concern right now. And I can imagine if it's hard to get people excited about caring about a minnow, it may be even harder to get them to care about a snake.
Yeah, snakes just get such a bad rap. And, I wish they didn't, because they're just really, really cool. And smooth green snakes, they're very cool looking. They're bright green. You can't mix them up with anything else. They're non-venomous. They pretty much just eat insects. They only get to about 22 inches, so not even 2 feet long. And they're pretty benign as snakes go. And, you know, snakes play just such an important role in our landscape and are really fascinating creatures.
And so, why are they at risk?
Habitat loss, again, they like sort of open prairie areas and particularly those that are a little wetter. They also, because they eat insects, you know, they may be impacted by pesticide use and stuff like that that impacts the insect population.
All right. Well, like I said, I want to bring another guest into the conversation and give both of you a chance to talk about another species here. Jared McGovern is joining us. He's Senior Education Manager at the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque. Hello, Jared.
Hey, good morning, good morning, good morning. How's everybody doing?
Great. Welcome to the show. And I wanted to give you and Stephanie both a chance to talk a little bit about the wood turtle. So, Jared, tell us about this species of turtle.
So the wood turtle is pretty nifty. We used to have those here at the Museum and Aquarium when we had our turtles, Secrets of the Shell exhibit here, and we exhibited these animals. And first off, they're beautiful. Secondly, they're crazy intelligent. There were a couple articles that I had read while they were here on how these animals could be taught to run mazes, how they went up stairs during their migration when they're going out to lay eggs, and that they're fairly rare in Iowa. The only population that I'm aware of, and I'm sure Stephanie can speak to this much better than myself, is in the headwaters of the Cedar River. And it's also a turtle of concern because it is targeted for the turtle trade, for the pet trade, and it is illegally exported to other countries. The Museum and Aquarium, for instance, we bring in turtles that the Fish and Wildlife Service has confiscated that are trying to be exported to other countries, specifically to countries like China, where turtle meat is a staple, as well as turtle products, lotions, powders, things like that. And when these animals are confiscated, they don't have anywhere else to go. They don't know where they came from. So what they'll do with zoos and aquariums and nature centers across the country is these facilities will take these animals in. And we work with one or two, actually, that do that. The Mines of Spain State Recreation Area, as well as Maquoketa Caves, has two of those such wood turtles that were confiscated as part of that project. So, I mean, that's what I know about turtles. Stephanie, yeah. What do you got?
What makes these wood turtles so cool?
What makes
these
well,
oh, so yeah, it's Stephanie, yeah.
Yeah, so, first of all, they're called wood turtles because their shell kind of has a look of wood. It's very it's kind of spiky and looks like wood, so that's kind of how it got its name. And they're very specific about the types of rivers they use, and they need rivers with a lot of woods along it, but also with some openings where they can nest and stuff. So They've been impacted, I think, their populations with the increased flooding that we've had in the state over the last few years. It washes out their nest quite a bit if it floods in the floodplain. So one of the things we've been doing is just kind of nest mounds or big dirt that are set back a ways from the river to try and get them to like move further away from the edge of the river to the nest and stuff. And that's been somewhat successful.
And this is a species that the DNR is working hard on right now to track and learn about, right?
Yeah, we have a University of Northern Iowa, we have a grant that and they've been working on putting transmitters on a number of these turtles to again figure out like where they're nesting and how they move around in the river. That grant is actually multi-state, so it's not just Iowa, it also includes other states. So there's a lot of work here in the upper Midwest on with turtles.
Stephanie, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you.
Stephanie Shepherd, wildlife biologist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. We're going to let Stephanie go. Jared, you stay with us. Jared McGovern is a senior education manager at the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about some of the smaller species that live in Iowa, species that are endangered, threatened, or of special concern. And with me right now is Jared McGovern. He is Senior Education Manager at the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque. And Jared, we were talking earlier about how, you know, there are some species that are easy to get people to care about. Maybe they're beautiful or charismatic or special in some way. We've saved a couple species to talk to you about that are maybe a little bit harder to get people to care about. And one of those is the Iowa Pleistocene snail. Tell me a little bit about that snail.
So where I'm at here in Dubuque, Iowa, we're in what is known as the Driftless area. So it's an area that was void of glaciation about 16,500 years ago. And the Iowa Pleistocene snail is a remnant population from the last ice age, and you're going to find them usually on hillside slopes, what are known as algific talus slopes, and what that is that's an area that is going to be much cooler than the surrounding environment. So these little microclimates that in the middle of summer could be around 40 to 50 degrees because you have this cool vent that's coming out the side of the hill, and you're going to find these Pleistocene snails living in those areas. I was actually just on the phone earlier today with Kevin Rowe with Iowa State University and their Natural Resource Ecology and Management Program, and he was telling me that those remnant populations in northeast Iowa, they're genetically unique from each other because of the isolation that they've occurred and because their populations are so small.
So that means that they haven't been able to interbreed, so they're continuing to evolve into maybe distinct species?
Maybe. I can't speak to that personally, but what I can tell you is in the work that Kevin's been doing with the genetics is that, yes, they are genetically distinct. They're different from each other, but more than likely not separate species.
So now that's really cool. Again, let's talk about why people should get excited about a snail and care about protecting it.
Well, snails are awesome. Have you ever had one crawl on your hand?
I mean,
it's the funniest thing. And when you watch them leave their little slime trails all over the place, it's fantastic, right? So
besides the
fact that they're super cool animals, they're part of that ecosystem. And any of the animals that are part of the ecosystems we have in Iowa, no matter how big, no matter how small, they play a role. And within the sustainability mindset is that role is going to ultimately impact people in the long term. If we're going to be conserving our land for long-term human survival, then we need to be conserving the entire habitat and worrying about every single little thing, no matter how tiny and how small of a role that they play in that ecosystem. They are important. And these particular guys would be considered decomposers. Most of them feed on leaf litter that's fallen from the tree canopy.
So they're helping us out in that way, and they're a connection to really a prehistoric time as well. Let's talk about another species, or many different kinds, actually, of freshwater mussels. These are animals that, again, maybe are hard for people to love, hard for people to care about, but they're such an interesting and important part of the ecosystem. Let's talk about the freshwater mussels in North America. About 72% of all of them need some kind of protection, right?
Yes. So this is my jam, and this is the jam here now at the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium. We have kind of doubled down on our freshwater mussel conservation initiatives. We are a member of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, and so we do more than entertain and educate. We also practice in situ and ex situ conservation work. So what we do here at the museum is work with an animal that barely has a brain, has no eyes. It knows what fish eat. It looks like a rock. It feels like a loogie on the inside, and the thing is so diverse in North America, you wouldn't believe it. There's 297 species of freshwater mussel in North America, and there's 39 of them that were recently identified in the state of Iowa alone. These animals, they're extremely important to all of the aquatic ecosystems that we have in Iowa, specifically on the Mississippi River, where they are a keystone species. And what I mean by that is they create a physical habitat with their bodies that would not otherwise exist without them. It's attuned to what some may refer to as a freshwater coral reef. And to kind of lighten the mood, when I think of freshwater mussels, I always think of that SNL sketch with Hans and Franz and Pump You Up. Just so you know, mussels is M-U-S-S-E-L-S, not M-U-S-C-L-E-S.
So the freshwater mussels, of course, they were harvested heavily. We know that muscatine was kind of the center of the button-making industry for a long time. What else has put these creatures at risk?
So what's interesting is I read a book as part of my graduate program called Shell Games, and in that book it's really about workers' rights and unionization in America. And in this particular case, they were explaining it through the lens of what happened in Muscatine with the pearl button industry. And that was in about 1910, 1911. Around the same time that the mussel industry was at its peak and we were harvesting millions and millions of these animals from the river, we were also changing the river drastically. We were dredging it, we were channelizing it, the lock and dam systems were built in the late 20s and the early 30s. And then our landscape was changing as well. I mean, this is when huge tracts of prairie and ground were being drastically altered. Therefore, erosion and sedimentation were occurring. And these animals live on the bottom. They can't move very fast. But then we also had, at the same time, a lot of people starting to build these cities near our rivers and in industry growing in these rivers. And so point pollution, sewage or industrial pollution, was also on the rise around the same time. So these animals were being hit from pretty much all sides, and it wasn't until later that we recognized how important they were to the river's ecosystem, not just to the economy. And that's the beauty of people, I would say, and the beauty of conservation and the beauty of the work that everyone on this call does, is we believe in hope and we believe that people are the solution to these conservation issues. And so there is hope. There's always going to be hope. And that is being shown by the work that the Iowa DNR, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the River Museum and Aquarium, different zoos around the country, as well as state DNRs and nonprofits are doing to bring these little goofy-looking critters that sit on the bottom, suck water in, spit water out, make something called pseudo-feces, fake poop. They're so cool. I love them.
Are they at risk because of invasive species? I'm thinking, of course, of the zebra mussel in particular.
So that would be the most recent one, I would say, is the zebra mussel. Yes. Zebra mussels have a different life cycle than freshwater mussels. Freshwater mussels require a fish host. These things are parasites for part of their life, except for one, it sucks the blood of a mud puppy. And freshwater, or the zebra mussels, don't require that. And zebra mussels also are going to be attaching to solid surfaces, these solid physical habitats on the bottom of the rivers. That is a great surface for zebra mussels to connect. And as I described to a young man yesterday, if you remember sleepovers or playing football out in the field and you got 15, 20 people piling on top of each other, you're not going to be able to breathe very well if you're the guy on the bottom. And that's kind of what's happening with zebra mussels on freshwater mussels. There's so many of them that the mussels then have a hard time feeding or even breathing, and they may eventually die.
And we were talking earlier about how some of these species are kind of canaries in the coal mine, species that tell us a lot about our water quality and our environment. Do you feel like freshwater mussels fall into that category as well?
Yes. There's actually a really one of my favorite success stories of freshwater mussel conservation comes from just south of Minneapolis-St. Paul. And about Pool 1, which is just up from Lock and Dam 1, and then Pool 2, which is just up from Lock and Dam 2, are just below Minneapolis-St. Paul. And before, and I'm not sure on the exact date, but at one time there really were no mussels that were in those stretches of the Mississippi River because of point pollution, industrial pollution, the sawmills that were in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, the population, the raw sewage that was coming into the river. But they've come back. And in part because of the Minnesota DNR and the Genoa National Fish Hatchery and organizations like the museum that have been stocking out mussels, but also there's been natural migration of these mussels attached to the fish gills, and as the water quality has improved, the mussel populations have started to grow in those areas again. So they need healthy river systems. They can't move very far. And if oxygen drops on the bottom where you have a huge erosion event that covers the mussel beds, they're very susceptible to those changes in their environment.
Well, Jared, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, I'm happy to do it. Thanks for having me, and I hope your listeners have a greater appreciation for freshwater mussels.
Jared McGovern is Senior Education Manager at the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque. My final guest today is John Pearson, a botanist and ecologist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Hello, John.
Hello.
And if it's hard to get people to care about mussels or snails, I think you have a greater challenge when we talk about plant species that are at risk in Iowa. Is that a hard thing to get people excited about and to get people concerned about?
Well, I think it varies with your experience. We certainly have a lot of interested botanists and amateur botanists and naturalists who are very, very enthused about plants. Certainly, at the other end of the scale, you probably have people who are not very familiar with wild plants or wild flowers, and it's a new thing to them.
Now, there are more than 300 species of plants on the state endangered list. Can you give me an idea of some of the patterns? What seems to put these plants at risk?
Right. Let me clarify. We have endangered and threatened and special concern. And those three is all those three categories combined. But as many of your speakers before today have already mentioned, the common denominator is habitat loss. There's certainly been a big alteration in the original habitat since Iowa was settled. And certainly, you know, agricultural conversion of vast areas of prairie, a lot of urbanization, effects of polluting the streams, that sort of thing. All these things contribute towards declines of species that enjoyed a different type of environment.
Now, given how dramatically altered our landscape is in Iowa from what was here before settlement, do you think that a lot of plants that used to exist in Iowa have already been extirpated?
Well, that's always a little difficult question to answer because we can only count what we see today, and we don't know what was here if we didn't see it because we didn't get here in time. But that said, I've been able to do some research on, it seems like most of the species that were reported by early botanists are, in fact, still in the state. Not many, and there isn't an overwhelming number that have disappeared completely. There are some. However, many of those are in very precarious conditions today, and it wouldn't take much additional loss to lose them. So we're kind of at a crossroads right now where if we have an effort to conserve them, I think we'll be successful. If we don't make the effort, we will, in fact, see that loss continue, and they will, in fact, disappear.
Let's talk about just a couple of the plants on this list. Let's talk about Mead's milkweed, which is a federally endangered plant. Tell me about this one.
Yeah, that is probably our rarest, one of our rarest plants in the state. Certainly, it's our rarest federally listed species. We only know of three places in Iowa where we can reliably expect to go and find it today. It was likely much more widespread over the southeast half of the state. We have some old records clear over in eastern Iowa, but most of those populations I'm talking about, we know about, are all concentrated in the southwest quarter of Iowa. They typically occur in a very high-quality tall grass prairie, which is itself very rare, probably an explanation of what's going on here.
And if there's an endangered plant species, and we know about it, and we know what environment it grows in, it seems like that would make it easier to save than an animal species, because you don't have to trap it. You don't have to create necessarily the same kind of environment to allow it to procreate. So what are the things in play that make it difficult to save a species like Mead's milkweed?
Well, it's very closely associated with high-quality native prairie. Native prairie itself very rare, and just the mere fact that these remnants are fragmented and highly separated from each other makes it difficult for the plants in them to cross-pollinate or send their seed across many miles of empty territory to land in exactly the right place. So that's a lot of times it's the fragmentation itself that's causing the issue, and the only solutions to that would be either to start managing the landscape to allow for more that are more friendly to prairie-like conditions, or you have to get into the labor-intensive work of actually hand-pollinating these very rare species.
Let's talk about eastern and western prairie-fringed orchids, and these are two species, although we used to think that they were just one species. Describe them for me.
Yeah, well, these are probably one of our most charismatic, visually striking species. They're just about 1 to 3 feet tall. They have this beautiful fringed white petal on them that makes them just very visually appealing to anyone who's ever seen one or ever seen a picture of one. And again, this is another tall grass prairie species. All the populations we've ever known about in Iowa are associated with, by and large, with tall grass prairie. Yes, indeed, this was considered one species until about 20 years ago, and then it was discovered that there are actually two species that look virtually identical. It's a very interesting story behind that. These plants are pollinated by moths, in particular the hawk moth, or what people might recognize as a hummingbird moth or a sphinx moth, the ones that hover in front of flowers as they probe their tongue down there looking for nectar. The pollen of these plants are not actually dust-like most other plants. These are concentrated into little balls called pollinia. And these pollinia stick to the forehead and the eyes of these hawk moths, and that's what actually accomplishes pollination as they move from plant to plant. And it turns out that these two species have different arrangements of their pollen-producing and pollen-accepting parts of their flower, such that a hawk moth that pollinates the first species won't be able to put the pollen in the right place on the other species. So they actually have become two separate species.
Wow. It is fascinating. And clearly there's so much more to learn about these species. John Pearson, thank you so much for being on the show with us.
Thank you.
John Pearson is a botanist and ecologist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. This hour, we've been talking about some of the small species that are at risk in Iowa, that are endangered, threatened, or of special concern. Of course, we haven't talked about all the species of animals, insects, or plants that are endangered, but we've learned a lot about a lot of them this hour. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Dennis Reist. We had production assistance today from Shirley Wong. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.